A new thriller about a small-time burglar who finds more than he bargained for during a home invasion hits theaters this week. The film is Bad Samaritan and capably plays with some of the conventions of the thriller genre. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. My guest today has produced a wide array of feature films over a 25-year career, with a filmography that ranges from blockbuster titles like Stargate, Independence Day, and Godzilla, to historical action films such as The Patriot and Flyboys. Dean Devlin has also directed a number of television and theatrical films over the last decade, including the new thriller Bad Samaritan, which opened yesterday at several theaters in El Paso. Dean Devlin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, good morning, sir. You are no stranger to genre filmmaking. As a producer and director, you've made some very large science fiction and disaster films. But this latest film, Bad Samaritan, is really something a bit different than I think what most people know your name for. How did you get started or attracted to this project?
Well, a few years ago, a writer friend of mine named Brandon Boyce, who had done the movie App Pupil and Wicker
Sure.
Park, he had just finished a new script, and he called me up and said that he was about to send it out, and would I give him some notes for some last-minute corrections before he put it out in the world. So I read the script. I thought it was fantastic. I couldn't put it down, and I called him back, and I said, well, look, I only have one note for you, and that note is, don't show this to anybody, because I want it. And it just reminded me of kind of a early Brian De Palma movies and the kind of thrillers I grew up on.
Yes.
It was the kind of thriller that made me, you know, frightened, but also kept me on the edge of my seat. And, I mean, look, we've had a lot of fantastic, scary movies the last couple of years, but they tend to be about either some kind of scientific development, you know, like in Don't Breathe, I mean, in the Get Out, or there's something... It's like some creatures, like in Quiet Place, or some supernatural event. But to me, you know, the kind of horror that could actually live across the street from us, the kind of horror that really does exist in our society, that's the most frightening thing ever. So when I read this script, it just chilled me. And I knew it was unlike anything I'd ever done before, but it just really made me excited to try it.
Could you give our listeners a little taste without giving away too many spoilers of what this story is about?
Well, we give quite a bit away in the trailers. I won't give away more than that. But basically, the idea is it's two young guys who work as valet parkers at a high-end restaurant, and they've come up with this little scam, is that if someone has an expensive enough car, they check the GPS or the registration and see if they live close enough to the restaurant. If they do, they rob the house while the people are having dinner. But on this one night, they end up robbing the wrong person's house, and they find that they violated the house of a very dangerous serial killer.
Yeah, and it doesn't unfold the way I thought it would. Talking earlier with you, and you were referencing maybe the early Brian De Palma films you saw growing up, I also thought it had a certain Hitchcockian element to the first half of the film and how the story plays out. It really goes against the convention and your expectations of where that story might lead. David Tennant is this very American psycho, even though he's British, but he does a beautiful job of being this guy with too much money and time on his hands who's gotten into some really dark serial killing places, and these guys accidentally fall into that story. I'm wondering, since you were referencing Brian De Palma, are there certain thrillers that call back to you that you're inspired by, that you thought of, or that you referenced in preparing to make this film?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the Brian De Palma was clearly influenced by Hitchcock in his early films, and there was something he was doing stylistically that kind of tickled me in films like, well, Terry or Dressed to Kill.
Sure.
But even more recently, I mean, not super recently, to show how old I am, but you know, even a movie like Disturbia, which had its roots in Hitchcock cinema language.
Sort of a modern Rear Window.
Yeah. And then obviously Silence of the Lambs, you know, to me, that was the bar for the great psychopath in a movie. And, you know, so I had to kind of study that a little bit. But what's interesting is that the writer actually wasn't thinking about any of those things. The writer was actually focused on Othello.
Interesting.
Because he saw Cale's destruction, our bad guy's destruction of our heroes, similar to what Iago did to Othello, the way he was able to systematically break him down. So I thought it was kind of interesting how we came to it from different places.
Yeah, I don't think it's giving away anything that this quickly develops into a cat and mouse game where you think when your young protagonist, who's a amateur burglar, decides he's really got to tell the police about what's happened, that it's going to become a procedural thriller of the police trying to track this killer. But really, they don't give him much credence. And it's the young man who really has to set about trying to stop this guy. And instead of running away, David Tennant's serial killer turns the tables and really decides to wreck this young man's life and the life of his family. And it goes in places that I didn't expect. So it's interesting that your writer was thinking Othello and you were thinking Brian De Palma.
Well, I think one of the things that was there in the script that I really loved is that often in these kind of movies, in order to make the plot move forward, it kind of relies on the police being stupid. Hmm. And what I really liked in the script is that the police are never stupid. The FBI are never stupid in this. It's just the villain is that much smarter.
Right.
And so he's able to manipulate a situation where, in a very credible way, the police are able to discount the stories they're being told by our hero. And, you know, I think by doing so, he set the bar a little bit harder for himself to write the script. But I think the end result is a smarter movie and a much better villain.
And speaking of smart, there's a lot of smart devices in this. So it's definitely rooted in the here and now, the way in which the protagonist and the villain use social media and passwords and GPS and all of the devices that we have at our fingertips, literally to become investigators ourselves, the way in which you and the screenwriter integrate all of these accoutrements of the modern age into the story, I think was fairly unique as well.
Well, you know, traditionally in thrillers, you have to isolate your heroes, right? So they're vulnerable. And it's so hard today to believe that we could be isolated because we're so interconnected in all of our technology. And I think, you know, what we were trying to do was actually to show the vulnerability mm-hmm. and the false sense of security we have with our technology and to see how it can absolutely be used against us.
That's a great point. I wanted to ask you as a director, not just the producer of the film, but I'm wondering if you approach a film like this differently in pre-production than, say, one of your globe-hopping disaster films. Obviously, it's not as logistics-heavy. This film is mostly based in Portland, Oregon. How do you modulate between all of these different scales of projects that you take on?
I'll tell you what I learned very early on, and my father, who was a movie producer, kind of taught me this from the beginning, is there's this fallacy that smaller movies are easier to make than bigger movies.
Right.
And the truth is all productions are incredibly difficult. They just have their own challenges. You know, usually the challenges you have on a smaller movie is how little money you have and how little time you have to do it. And on this movie, we got hit with 5 snowstorms, so it added additional problems. But I think that the biggest difference for me was not the size of the production, but it was being able to work completely independently. And, you know, what I've really discovered is that when I'm looking in the mirror and being very kind of honest with myself on who I am as a person, I realize that I do much better work outside of the studio system than in the studio system. I'm just not the right personality type to work at the studios. And every time I've had the opportunity to work outside of it, I've made a better product, I've had more fun, and I'm more proud of what I've done.
Interesting. And because you can explore characters more than maybe in the big action films?
Well, I think that the thing is, I mean, even our television was completely independent. So I don't know if it's so much that as much as to try and do something that stays on course to what you've intended to do.
Hmm. Closer.
You really can't do that by committee. Now, that's not to say that film's not collaborative. I mean, I think this movie, that's one of the most collaborative thing I've ever done. But it was all collaboration for the same motivation, as opposed to now we're in situations in studios where there's a lot of different voices and a lot of different agendas. And to be able to navigate that, you really have to be a certain kind of bully. And if you don't have that ability to just charge through and force the will of a lot of different agendas, it's very hard to keep a vision at a studio. Independently, you tend to get an attitude from your crew and the people involved that they're all rowing in the same direction.
That's some great insight, I think, for our listeners and myself. you've also done some acting over your long career as a producer and director. You've appeared here and there.
I like to refer to myself not as a former actor, but as a reformed actor. Right. You know, every day and every way I'm getting better and better.
Well, but that little bit of acting you've done in during a long career, I'm wondering if that helps you better understand as a director how to direct actors, or at least how not to direct actors.
Well, I mean, you'd have to talk to the actors who've worked with me, but I think they tend to enjoy the experience because I'm very willing to alter the way I prefer to work to support whatever they like to do. You know, I mean, every actor approaches things differently. I mean, for instance, I am very much against table reads, and I'm very much against rehearsing. Mm-hmm. I really like it to happen live in front of the camera. Now, for some actors, that's a gift. You know, they really love that. Other actors can't stand it. They really want to rehearse and rehearse and rehearse. So if I find an actor who prefers to work that way, I'll rehearse with them. I'll do what they need to get to where they have to go. So, you know, I think maybe my background as an actor was coming to the understanding that not all techniques are the same, and there is no one technique better than the other. It's really what is the right technique for that individual actor.
Right. So you have in mind that the goal, but not necessarily how to get there, whatever it takes with each actor is what's fine with you to get out
That's
of
right.
them the performance you're looking for. I have to ask you, since you've worked on so many and you've brought so many big films to the screen, it seems like the last few years we hear from time to time people in the film industry popping up thinking that we're approaching the end or the collapse of the big budget effects heavy blockbuster era that's we've been in for decades. And yet, as soon as we hear that, it seems like the films just get bigger and make more money and are more successful. As someone who spent a lot of time developing these types of films, I'm wondering if you have any particular insights into the future of the blockbuster. Is it going to evolve or go away?
I think the danger that we are facing is not limited to the blockbuster. I think the danger that we are facing is the end of the theatrical experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're watching every single year attendance dropping. And my personal belief is that there had been a decision made amongst the studios some 10 years ago that all films needed to prove that there was a pre-existing audience before
yes.
they'd be willing to make the movie. Therefore, all films have to be based on either a successful TV series or a successful video game or be a remake or a sequel. And while I understand the logic of that as a corporation trying to make a decision on what products to make, it's against what made movies exciting. In other words, with that philosophy, there never would have been an Indiana Jones or an E.T. or a Star Wars. So I think that while many of these franchises are quite good, you know, and I applaud how they've been able to keep the quality up, I think as a viewing audience, we need a lot of different venue items to keep the experience fresh and to keep it being an exciting place to go. But if everything you see, you've kind of seen before in some other form, at some point it's a little bit like kissing your sister.
Hmm.
You know, I think this is why we're seeing viewers starting to gravitate to other means of entertainment. And I think this would be a giant shame. So you know, my hope is that these independents that are popping up, these independent companies, I'm hoping that companies like this can start to bring back some of the menu items that the studio is no longer making. And maybe we can start to revitalize why it was so exciting to go to the movies.
Hmm. And that seems to dovetail back into why you made Bad Samaritan, was you were looking to be refreshed yourself and in your creative freedom, but also maybe bring something fresh back to the theater, that type of thriller that we haven't seen in a while.
Well, the way I've always ran my career is from the perspective of a fan. In other words, I always set out to do what I couldn't go see. So I always kind of went from, what do I want to go see, and why can't I see it? And if I can't see it, then let's go make it. And for the most part, that served me very well in my career. And you know, so this was, again, me looking to do a certain type of scary movie that I wasn't seeing other people do.
Well, that's a great reason to do it, and I know it gets you through the long, hard days that it takes to actually make a film. So I certainly appreciate you taking the time to call in and talk to us from Hawaii. And I wish you all the best with your latest film, Bad Samaritan. It's great to speak with you, Mr. Devlin.
Great to speak with you, and aloha.
Thank you. My guest today has been Dean Devlin, producer and director of the new thriller Bad Samaritan. Bad Samaritan opened this week in local theaters and is rated R, mainly for language and some violence. To find out more about the film, log on to badsamaritanfilm.com. For an extended version of my discussion with Dean Devlin, log on to ktep.org. On Film's producer is Lauren Terrazas. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.